Hey, believe it or not, this is the recorded voice of your pal Sid Straw. And I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, my friends, welcome to the neighborhood on this Saturday morning. You know, with my teeth, with my jaw, with my problems, I can barely drink anything these days without a straw. But on this particular episode of the Dave's Gone By radio program of the air, I am thrilled to have a very special straw, a talented straw, a Sid Straw. She is a singer and a songwriter. She was in the Golden Palominos for a couple of albums and has worked with all these people that you have heard of that we'll ask her about. Plus, she has a couple of solo albums out, just a couple. Not sure why she doesn't have more. We'll ask her about that too. She's been an actress, she's been a backup singer, and she is a solo artist still. As a matter of fact, tonight, this Saturday night, she is at Joe's Pub on Lafayette Street in New York at 7 p.m. Please go see her. Sid Straw has said in an interview a few years ago, quote, "I know that my appeal is kind of wide, but limited. I accepted that a long time ago. Here are the only opinions that I care about. I care about good, smart people." Why the hell she's talking to me is a mystery, but here she is in the neighborhood. Please welcome Shalom Sid Straw.
Shalom, shalom, hooray, hello. That was quite an effusive intro, and I appreciate that, Rabbi Saul.
Oh, you're most welcome. People are usually very grateful when they first start talking to me, and then 10 minutes into the interview, they're like, what the hell have I gotten myself into? But for now...
That's when you'll find that this side of the line, you know, disappears, you know, so... Yeah, keep it on the up low.
I'll keep it on. I've never heard that. On the up low. This is why you're a writer. You think of these terms. But you're feeling well? Everything is good?
Oh, wow. You know, the Earth has some problems, and it concerns me. But in more specific terms, I am on a glide. I am having a beautiful time.
Are you on part of a tour now, or is this Joe's Pub show a one-off?
Well... That's a funny question, because I'm in California at this moment, but somehow, due to the miracle of pre-recording, I will find myself this evening singing in New York City on my way back to Vermont. So it is a kind of a tour, a kind of whimsical, theoretical tour, and I'd love to add more dates to it.
Well, I'm sure people around the country would love to see you on more dates. Now, you're back in Vermont. Didn't you move to L.A. for a period, or did you end up staying in Vermont?
Oh, I'm always bouncing back and forth and back and forth between New York and Vermont and L.A., where I was born. Maybe I'm a fair-weather friend. My friend imported me to L.A. and extricated me from the fierce winter that we all had. And I've been out here working ever since the end of February. I have been just re-involving myself with important people and creative aspects.
Well, see, that's one of the things I want to ask about. I mean, if people judge you just by the fact that you have three albums out, you know, half a decade apart, they're going to wonder, when you say you're working, where, what, doing what? Is it voiceover work for cartoons, or what are you doing?
Wouldn't that be great? I'm so ready to be a cartoon voice. I feel like I'm overqualified for that.
Okay.
I am always working, whether it's... Perhaps I'm too private about it. You know, I'm always working, but whether I find outlets to get it out of my living room and into the world, this is the challenge. But this is the challenge I'm taking up, because I am not unaware that I could be far more prolific and that I'm expensive and hard to find.
Expensive and hard to find. So that sounds like a Torah. No, but let me ask you, like the past since February, let's say, what have you been doing that people could either turn on TV and watch, or turn on a record player, or what?
Well, a very exciting tangent I've been on is I've been working with the very great band Los Lobos.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And so I've been doing some shows with Los Lobos, and I had the exciting privilege of singing on their new record that will come out this fall. And busy involved in trying to make a film about Los Lobos because I love them. Something really important that I'm working on.
As a producer, as a director, or what?
All of it, Rabbi.
Okay.
I've got ambition. It's just that I forgot which pocket I left it in. I'm getting a lot of help from talented friends in all walks of the showbiz life. There's a lot of good grace kind of surrounding this. I'll call it a project, this passion project. That's something I'm very busy doing, is trying to help tell stories of the amazing, overly talented friends that I get to bang around this planet with. So I want to tell those stories, and Los Lobos is a beautiful story.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, that's the one thing that from the very beginnings of your career, you never seem to have problems meeting up with and creatively joining people that we go like, oh my God, Matthew Sweet, Richard Thompson, Michael Stipe, just like magic, they're magnetized to you. How does that happen?
I hope that they're magnetized to me. I haven't seen those people in a while.
All right. Well, early on, in other words, meeting people when you were back in the early 1980s, how did you suddenly hook up with the Golden Palominos?
Oh, that's a good story.
Well, tell it.
I went to a club on Bleecker Street in New York City called Bitter End.
Oh, yes, still and, there.
And so are we, oddly enough.
Oddly enough, yes.
I met this fellow there, Anton Fear, and he walked me home in the rain, and he scribbled his phone number on the most minuscule scrap of paper and stuck it in my pocket.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I believe there might have been some liquor involved, and I think he proposed.
Well, was it your back pocket, perhaps?
I'm looking to get married, but maybe we could do some music together.
And you ended up doing music together instead of the marriage thing. Is he, by the way, was he the drummer for the Letterman Band for many years?
Not to be confused with the wonderful Anton Fig.
Oh, sorry, you're right. Duh.
I always made theoretical T-shirts, and I wanted to give one to Anton Fig that said, Fig, not fear. And I want to give one to Anton Fear that, of course, would say fear, not fig.
Very cute. So, but no, it's Anton Fear, my mistake, that the proposed to you, but proposed to do music together. And was he in the Golden Palominos already at that point?
Oh, yes. This is his project. And I just joined up for a while. That was a great learning experience. I carry it with me.
Why didn't you stay after the two albums that you did with them? You wanted to concentrate on your solo stuff?
Well, you know, I would have stayed if I had been treated more beautifully.
Okay.
I wanted to go do other things on my own terms. I guess I wanted to be in charge of my destiny, so that's why I left.
Okay, no, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, people come and go, and the Palominos have certainly had turnover and changes in their career.
But absolutely, yeah. And I'm friends with everybody who, joined the band after me, so it's a beautiful thing. Hey, this is the recorded voice of your pal Sid Straw, and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By.
Now, in releasing your first solo album back in 1989, Surprise, was it a surprise to you that you became a songwriter as opposed to a backup singer or a cover person of other people's songs?
I like that question because I'm still surprised and gloriously happy to even consider myself a songwriter because I admire the deep songwriters so much. But I almost don't want to think of myself in the same sentence. But my songs, they demand a better mother. So I am trying to be one and get them out of the house. And amazing thing to be a songwriter, because how do you tell the difference, for instance, between when is a song a poem? When is a poem a song? When is a sonnet a mash note? I think it's all perfectly wonderful, so I'm happy to call myself a songwriter, but I don't march down the street proclaiming it that often.
Well, what was the first song you wrote as a grown-up?
Let's see. That would have been... there were songs from my extreme pop-punk youth, but I would say that the first song that really went somewhere probably was a song called Kind of True. That's from a record on the Golden Palominos. That's a song that... when I recorded my part, the great composer Carla Bley, B-L-E-Y, Carla, a great inspiration to me on every musical level. We were recording it in her house in Willow, in her studio in Willow, New York, and I remember vividly when she looked up and said, "Who wrote this?" And I said, "Well, I did." And she said, "You are a composer, Sid." And that changed my entire perspective of myself. And that's a song worth listening to. Visions of Excess is the record it's from.
And what's funny is that when I give sermons weekly at my temple, and people come up to me and they say, "You are an asshole, Saul." It makes me change the whole opinion of myself for that week. I mean, I know it instinctively, but...
I'm a little like Dave, did you know that?
Do I really? Wow. We're very close, you know.
I think you must be awfully close.
Well, he's rubbed off on me, and I've rubbed off on him, which sounds rather gay.
Don't tell me everything.
Now, since the whole country is in deep, sad mourning right now over the loss of the David Letterman show... we should mention that you appeared early on the Letterman show doing a song. And do you have any memories of that particular appearance? I know there's a briefcase involved. No idea what that was about.
You know, the briefcase got more close-ups than I did. What were they trying to tell me, Rabbi Saul?
Well, what were you trying to tell them by bringing a briefcase on stage and leaving it in the middle of the room? This is before 9/11. After that, everybody would have run out of the building.
You know what? I think it made them nervous even back then. And I do remember that Mr. Letterman wanted to know what was in that briefcase. And I remember I said to him, "A gentleman would never ask, Dave."
That's good.
And I do remember walking down the hallway. And one of the first things that they actually tell you, this was on the NBC version of the show. I never, unfortunately, made it onto the CBS show, and that seems too bad because it's so long since I did it, but I also had Dave Alvin, the great Dave Alvin, playing guitar with me. Then he had a chance to be on Letterman later, and he had me come on and sing harmony, so that was perfect. I just remember they say, "Hey, look, if you see Dave in the hall, if you see him on set, don't make contact." But that's not me, you know? That's just not me. So I do remember he was walking up the long hall, and I thought, "Oh, look how tall he is. Isn't he adorable? Hi, Dave."
Oh, okay. Well, you're a cute woman, so you probably got away with it.
I appreciate you saying that on the radio. People can just envision me as really cute now, and I hope you will. But he was very, very lovely to me.
Oh, good.
I saw both times I was on the show, and I feel like he's been at it a long time. I feel happy for him. He wants to do something else. Go with a dog. Go, Dave, go. Thanks for the memories.
And by the way, for people can even see on YouTube your appearance on the Letterman show. I love it that now everything is still there for all of us to see. It wasn't just you had to tune in, and if you didn't, you missed it. Now anybody with a computer can go see Sid Straw on Letterman 30 years ago, plus lots of other videos that you have done. Now, after the Surprise album, I am surprised.
I just did the math, Rabbi, and I think it was 26 years ago. Let's not push it, okay?
All right, I'm sorry. I'm thinking in terms of the 80s.
And let's not never use Roundup on our plants and gardens, people.
On our plant, let's not use, what is Roundup? I missed that joke.
Oh, it's not a joke. I'm serious. And people will know what I'm talking about. Do not use Roundup.
I have no idea what that, I'm in Colorado. Nothing grows here. What is Roundup?
Apparently. We'll talk about it later.
Okay, we don't have to do this. I assume it's a pesticide of some sort. I have no, honestly, no clue.
It's a pesticide that's literally devouring what's good about our world.
Oh, okay. Haven't heard of it. I'm out of it, you know.
That's great. I love that you're an innocent. That makes me think that you probably have weeds in your garden.
Well, I'm in Colorado. We have a very particular kind of weed in our garden these days.
Don't you know?
Actually, you have a story about that.
My next job in Colorado, speaking of such things.
Yeah.
How about a house concert at your temple?
At my temple? Wow. Would you play just for food? Because my parishioners have no money whatsoever. But if you like kosher food...
Very, 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 very good food.
Well, it's kosher food. So, it's not that good. Fattening, certainly. It'll raise your cholesterol rates if you need those to go up. Well, we can make that happen.
It's a plan.
It's a deal. Sid Straw coming to Colorado. But you know what? Don't wait until she comes to Colorado. She's at Joe's Pub tonight in Manhattan on 425 Lafayette Street, right across the street, or right part of the Public Theater, I should say. 7 o'clock tonight. There's a band opening for you. What are their names? The Will Something?
Oh, it's Winter Pills.
Winter
Pills. They're my darling friends from Northampton, Massachusetts, and they're amazing.
Man, so are you. Let me ask, though. You were signed to a label. You did the surprise album. The usual thing is there's a second record that comes out a year later. Why not?
That's the usual path people take. That sounds really... I guess I'm atypical.
Yes.
Because what happens is I wander off and get interested in a lot of other things. Then I remember... the short attention span of most humans, including myself, and then I wander back and try to put something else out. It horrifies and astonishes me how many years elapsed between my records. I'm really hoping to do something about that while I can.
Well, I'm surprised also because usually when you sign a contract with a label, it's usually a 3-record deal. And your next record didn't come out till 7 years later on another label. Were you just a 1-record contract originally for Surprise?
That's such a complicated question to answer. All I can really say is that the record business, they've got to look at their bottom line. And you've got to sell millions and millions and millions of records for them to keep their interest peaked. And, you know, I've just never been a household name. This is fine. But I would like to be more popular, but I think it has something to do with just the bottom line. And they would have had to spend so much money to keep me on. And I believe, you know what? It's funny that in my memory, they dropped Bob Mould and RBQ. And me on the very same sad day. And they did it because they needed to give $80 million to Janet Jackson. Couldn't you give her $79 million and keep me and Bob Mould and NRBQ? Come on.
Well, Bob Mould releases an album almost every year, so he's pretty prolific no matter what.
He's incredible.
You took a few more years to do your next album, which was called War and Peace, which has my favorite song of yours on it, called CBGBs. Can you tell us about that, the creation of that song?
I'm so pleased that you are aware of that song. That song really has good legs. That song gets around.
It has a nice ass, too, by the way.
but weak knees.
Unfortunately, yes. No, but was it based on a thing, or what made you want to write about that era, which I guess had already passed by the time you wrote the song?
It's true. I haven't played there in many years by the time I wrote that song, but it was a kind of a reverie. So I used to spend quite a bit of time in that beast of a club where rock music never sounded better anywhere else.
Hmm.
And when I heard that they were closing, it was already years ago, I got in touch with Hilly, who's now dearly departed. did, who ran the club, and I said, I'd like to come back. And so I got to play at CBGB's in the last week or so of its existence.
Wow.
And that was really a wonderful, wonderful way to complete that circle. I love that club, and I love the bands, and I loved, that was my college. I didn't really go to college, Rabbi Saul. I went to CBGB.
It's funny, I would see you more as a bottom line kind of person. Were you that punky?
And I missed that club so, so much. I never had a bad time at the bottom line.
I've never been, but Dave used to go to the, he never went to CBGB's. He was always terrified, the host of this show. Terrified of the bathroom there, terrified of, he always thought it was going to be like the Waco, Texas biker bars. So he stayed away from that, but he went to bottom line quite a few times. And that club he kind of misses, I have to say.
Oh, yeah. Well, these are clubs where a lot of greatness happened. I'm so lucky. I first played the bottom line with Van Dyke Parks on April 4th and 5th, 1984.
Wow.
And I remember it because it was such a beautiful, formative experience for me.
In what way? How come?
Because Van Dyke is a damn genius, or as he just, I'm getting sad because he just had these big shows in LA and I was able to go to one, and he was calling them his farewell shows.
Oh.
And I love him so much. And just yesterday in Highland Park, California, I ran into his wonderful son, Richard Parks, on the street, and we're just still involved in this figure eight of love.
And do you have any memories or Van Dyke Parks stories or anecdotes about him being brilliant or funny or unusual?
The image I would put in your radio mind is when I met him years ago, he threw open his front door and he said, "Straw, come on in." And I came in and I never really left.
Oh, that's sweet. And then was he wearing that Southern gentleman kind of apparel that we think of him in?
Well, you should see him in his seersucker suit changing a flat tire. There's an image. There's an image, and I am the witness to that. It was the most courtly tire changing imaginable. In his little blue and white seersucker suit with bow tie. Adorable.
Oh, and speaking of people that you have sung with and worked with and dealt with, even before the Van Dyke Parks and the Palominos, you sang back up for Pat Benatar. Do you have any Pat Benatar stories?
Well, I have a current Pat Benatar story.
Well, she's touring with Neil Giraldo still. She's doing a whole big thing, too, yeah.
I recently wrote a letter to Neil, just a little hello over the years. I'm in California. I would love to see you. And Pat and I would love to tell my story of singing backup years ago while Pat, I watched her from my microphone while she became a superstar. So Neil wrote back to me very graciously and said we would love to be a part of telling that story. And he's just the best and she's a phenomenon and I'm hoping to see them really soon.
Oh,
for the first time in many years.
Oh, no, that's wonderful. I mean, that's the thing about friendships and show business, whether you're in theater or doing music, it's kind of like you're closer friends, and then you don't see each other for a decade, and then you see each other again, and you pick up right where you left off. I think that happened with you and Matthew Sweet, right?
I love friendship like that. I think it's rare to find that kind of thing, but musicians really are. If I have to name a species, musicians are my favorite species, I mean, other than dogs. And I love my long-term and short-term and forever associations as I wander around the musical world. I can't even believe my good fortune sometimes and the people that I meet and work with.
Uh-huh.
It's a huge, big deal for my heart.
And I mentioned in that context, and also going back to the context in a way of Colorado, the first time you saw Matthew Sweet after a long, long time. Yeah, you told this in another interview, but Cher is kind of cute. How did he react? How did he approach you, as it were?
Oh, I think he walked right up to me, and just as ever, it had been many years, and I'm pretty sure that he goes, "Hey, Sid, got any weed?"
And you didn't. You weren't holding at that point.
I'm pretty sure. How do you know this, Rabbi Saul?
I have direct contact with God. So God tells me.
Oh, yes.
That's how I get the questions, yes. So
I have direct contact with dog.
Hey, is Henry still around? Or no?
My darling Henry Harris, my Labrador of love, he departed he took off for dog heaven on July 25th, 2 years ago. And now I'm so fortunate because I don't think I would have survived that loss. I'm not being hyperbolic. I had no plan to survive losing him, but I have a beautiful quadrupaw named Carol Burnett, and she is a Cork Wawa and a mystery girl, a rescue, who rescued me, and we are so happy together as we wander around.
Is she a Labrador also?
She is a Cork Wawa.
Oh, that's the actual name of a thing? A Cork Wawa?
That's what I call her. I'm not sure it's an official breed yet, but she's a very charming, important part of my existence.
Well, there's a reason you named her Carol Burnett. You actually met Carol Burnett when you were a child, right?
Oh, you've done some research.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
You researched me.
A bit. So tell. Because your dad, actually we should start, we haven't even talked about your parents yet, but your father was an actor. He was in the Pajama Game movie.
That's true, with Doris Day.
Yes, he has that big number, 7.5 cents, that he sings with, and that's probably his biggest claim to fame for people who might know him. So he knew some show people, including, apparently, Carol Burnett. So tell. Don't make me tell it, you tell it.
I like the way you tell it. It's interesting to hear your stories.
Well, they're your stories. I can tell my stories. You tell yours.
I think I should interview you.
One day, sure.
Well, when I was a kid, my dad ran an inn in Vermont. She came in, and I was the 7-year-old bartender. And I remember looking up, and my dad, he told me, we didn't have TV or anything. He told me she's very, very, very funny. She's the funniest woman. And I believed him because my dad was a most hilarious human. So I looked up at Carol Burnett, and I looked up over the bar, and I said, "What'll it be, Miss Burnett?" I probably shouldn't have been bartending at 7 years of age, but, you know, it was kind of a wild little inn in the woods.
Do you remember meeting any other people who were famous, but you didn't even realize it?
Well, you know, since it was an inn and people came there to be private, I don't think that I'm going to mention any other names. All kinds of people came through there, and they skinny-dipped in our pool.
Woo-hoo! Oh, come on, give us one name, especially if they're dead by now. If they're alive, I can understand, but anybody else you remember?
Yes, but you're not going to get it out of me.
Oh, damn it. Oh, well.
Keep the peace, and I like to keep the privacy, which, you know, is increasingly difficult in this cyberitic world.
Very true. Although things from 50, 60 years ago, they're not going to be all over the interwebs unless somebody starts telling stories as you are. But I don't think it's a bad story to tell that someone stayed in a little Vermont inn and maybe went into a pool naked. Unless they pished in the pool. Then that would be something you want to hide. I've done that.
They just look like manatees to me.
Now, you loved, it sounds like, both your mama and your papa. But I think
I still always do and will, and I miss them in a daily, deep way.
But something must have happened in your childhood at one point, because you even wrote a song that your mom took you away from your pop for a few years. What the hell?
Well, you know, D-I-V-O-R-C-E is not a pretty thing for anyone.
a divorce, there's a custody battle, there's a this, there's a that. You at one point mentioned somewhere that you were kidnapped.
Yes, it's true. On Valentine's Day.
Why was that necessitated?
Oh, you know, I don't think I can really go there in this interview with you.
Okay. All right. I mean, you know, we do the up stuff and the down stuff. We go all over the place.
I like, you know, deep and wide. It's fine by me. It's just that I feel that I need to percolate with those stories a little bit. And so...
Okay, so I mean, it's affecting you still.
They loved each other, but they couldn't make it work. And my brother and my sister and I sort of bandied about the country while I think they tried to figure out ways to be single parents. I love them all. I'm not in touch with my sister or my brother, but I love them all. And we're all raising ourselves now, as we must.
Well, see, life is short. Why are you not in touch with your own siblings?
Well, ask them. Call up and interview them.
Well, all right, if they're doing interesting
things. I'd like to hear their answer, because I keep trying.
Okay. All right. No, that's sad. I mean, it's one thing, you know, to have that stuff when we were 50 years ago, whatever it was. Sorry, 40. I don't want to age you, et cetera, and so forth. But you know, life's short not to know your own siblings. That's all I'm saying. And you feel that
way too. I agree, and I think it's probably very too complicated for radio waves. But
sure.
You know what, Rabbi Saul? I do send my love out to them, and I hope that it finds them. And we are all, due to free will, able to be free in this world to find your own family and find familial relationships. And I am, in fact, living for the last couple months with my friends Kitty and the Pipe, and they are...
Wait, Kiggy?
They're closer to me than my family, so we are family.
Kiggy and the Pipe? What?
Kitty and the Pipe.
I missed that.
Kitty and Pipe, because he is the Alaskan pipeline of rock. So I call him Pipe.
Okay, and who's Kitty? That's not your new, your Wawa, is it?
It's his lovely wife.
Oh.
And she's a genius travel agent, and she's the reason that Carol Burnett and I are flying from L.A. to New York first class tomorrow. Thank
Whoa.
You very much, Kitty.
First class, very nice indeed.
Posh. I like it posh, and it doesn't always happen that way, you get me?
Oh, believe me, I don't even ride coach. I hide in the tailpipe, you know. I can't afford anything. I just hope the propeller doesn't cut my head off one time. I'm lucky so far.
I'm with you. You better be careful.
Well, I fly Frontier sometimes, so there's a lot of other passengers who are there with me, because that's what Frontier basically does to you these days. But let me ask you, though. You're living with your friends, and you've been peripatetic in your living situations. You've never been...
That's a fancy word. Thanks for whipping that out.
I know. Yeah, that's also part of my research. I like to impress my guests to make them think I know something. But it took me a half hour just to be able to pronounce peripatetic. I worked on it just for you. But
look it up, kid. It means I get around.
That's right. You do. And I'm wondering, though, you've never been married. You dated, obviously. You've written songs about it.
That's untrue. Your research is faulty, Rabbi.
Oh, you were married.
I was married for a while. It ended in tragedy. Oh, well, enough about me.
I didn't realize that. I'm sorry. I didn't. That Wiki wasn't up on that
sorry.
Part.
It's not something I brag about on account of it. It didn't last very long. But you know what did last long?
What?
Is my friendship with the only man who was ever bold enough to put a ring on my finger. And he and his far superior current wife are dear friends of mine.
What is it like to stay friends with someone that you were married with? Because a lot of people can't do that. You know, they walk away and there's so much bitterness and stuff. How do you manage to say, hey, look, it wasn't meant to be 24/7 with us, but let's do dinner and I love your new wife and blah, blah, blah.
I really love them and I don't get to see them nearly as often as I would like to, but I think that everyone can wriggle out of situations without torching the time you had together. I see no reason why all of it must turn to ash. I like to remember what was good and magnify that so that I'm not consumed with bitterness.
That's wonderful. That's the best way to be, if possible. How has your dating life gone since then, though? Have there been any other near candidates? Anyone? Do you see yourself ever getting married in the future?
I would, if I fell deeply in love and that person wants to marry me and I want to marry them, I would love to be married to someone I loved immensely.
What about someone you just kind of tolerated?
I that door open in my mind.
Okay.
So I remain cautiously optimistic.
Ooh! But do you date mostly musicians, or do you go further afield, or what?
It's funny that you ask this, and I don't really think I should talk about this, but I did have a very lovely date only last night.
Ooh!
With a star tennis player.
A star tennis? Still on the circuit, or from, a previous star tennis player? You don't have to mention names.
I think he's doing other things now.
Okay.
He's a gorgeous tennis star, and he's gorgeous on the inside. His brain functions very much like a fast game of tennis. His return is pointed, direct, and immediate.
Whoa! So do you think there's a second date pending, happening?
I sure hope so.
Well, you go. But again, how do you do this? How do you meet these people? You know, not just an accountant, not just a thing, but you're singing with this person, you're singing with that person, and they're all famous. How do you do it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, maybe it has something to do with the fact that I don't really care that much about fame. And I care who a person is and not really how famous they are. I care what they are and not how well known they are, and I have respect for privacy, and I think you've got to always have that. Consequently, I think the people I work with and get to spend any time with, I'm a good private person, so they can be at ease with me, and I think this is key to the way I perambulate around this world. I think respect is the key. I don't know. But I think that I am kind of a lucky magnet for talent, and I'm a fool for beauty. And something really good usually happens when I get out of the house.
Huh. Something really good is going to be happening when Sid Straw comes out of her house, flies over first class to New York to be on stage tonight at Joe's Pub on Lafayette Street in New York. Tickets are ridiculously cheap, considering the entertainment that you're going to get tonight. And when you do perform, you're kind of known for these, for shows where you don't have this set list in front of you on a piece of paper typed out. I'm doing this song, and I'll banter a little bit, then this song, and this song. You keep it much looser than that. Why?
Sometimes, probably to my own detriment. I like the show to reveal itself at the point of purchase. I like a show to have a life of its own and kind of just be the conduit for whatever seems necessary or pertinent or impertinent at the time. I'm always a little rusty because I don't get to play enough. I just don't want to have to know what I'm doing fully in advance. It's not bad to have a roadmap, and this only works sometimes for me. I don't recommend it. I think it's probably a good idea to know what you're doing, but I sort of enjoy the process of finding out what I'm doing.
Well, are there one or two songs that you feel the audience expects you to do, or do you really have a tabula rasa when you begin a concert?
I feel like I am a tabula rasa that walks like a woman.
Wow! There's an image. Okay.
And I will honor requests if I know how to play them.
Fair enough.
I am very happy when people turn up and they want to hear something and I can deliver that, but it isn't always possible. There's lots of songs that I've recorded that I never did play guitar on, and I'm really quite very basic rhythm guitarist. I don't even know bar chords, Rabbi.
Oh my God.
I'm lazy and basic, so I would play anything if it seems worthwhile.
If it's D, G, B, A chords or E chords, then you're in good shape. Anything with a minor in it, you're screwed. Well, no, E minor is not too bad. You can probably do that one.
That's really true. That's probably the only minor I know. I might know E and A minor.
A minor. Yeah, A minor isn't bad. I have very stubby little fingers, so it's tough for me.
I can get better. I'm at it. I'm working.
Well, that's the whole point. You are working. And by the way, we were talking about marriage before and dating and stuff. Well, you do marriages. You are an ordained minister of a kind. How many marriages have you officiated? Have you done any brises, any funerals?
This is such a great... I would love to do a bris. I mean, I can't look. I won't watch.
No, hell no. I do them and I can't watch.
To the living room to say hello to Kitty. No, you don't want to say hello? Just say... Here was the question, Kitty. Asked me. Apparently, you officiate at weddings, and I've already told him I've been living here since the end of February with you and the pipe. I'm looking at a picture Rabbi Saul taken at their wedding, and I did officiate at their wedding. And then I jumped up with the awesome, awesome wedding band, including the groom, the pipe, and played Highway to Hell. I am available for weddings. Call me.
Highway to Hell. There's the first dance number, or the father-daughter dance. To do Highway to Hell.
I'm into family is very important. Kitty just hollered as I was walking back into the kitchen. We're still married, so apparently I do good work. That was fun. You just came into the living room for an excursion with me.
Oh, that was pleasant. I needed the walk. I needed to stretch my legs there. But I want to stay on the wedding topic because there's a great story of the very first wedding that you ever officiated between two writers. One of them, rather a prickly person, apparently. Can you tell that story?
Beautiful, beautiful prickly pear. She's really one of the sweetest little brownie scouts around.
Well, you make her sound kind of mean.
No, I'm just magnifying the ridiculousness of the story.
Well, tell.
Oh, no, I didn't officiate at that wedding, but I was asked to sing at a wedding of my dear friend's Mary Gateskin and Peter Trachtenberg, and it was 4 days after 9/11. And I did write a lovely song at 90 miles an hour on the way to the wedding, which ended up being a song on War and Peace. No, it's on Pink Velour.
Your third album, Pink Velour, yeah.
Pink Velour. I dropped that as if people know what I'm talking about, but I did make a record that I put out the day after President Obama was first elected, and it's called Pink Velour, and there's a song on it called Marry Me, which is worth checking out. I think it's a pretty decent song, and it was written at 90 miles an hour on the way to the wedding. But you know what? The truth is, they really wanted to hear Perfect Day by Lou Reed, and that's all. I couldn't give them what they had asked for.
She was apparently glaring at you from the dais. She's like, look, it's nice that you wrote a song for us. It's all right, but we asked for Lou Reed. She was ticked off at you.
Well, you know what? Lou Reed didn't show up at their wedding, did he? But I did, with my pithy little tune.
Good for you. Did you ever meet Lou Reed? Every story I hear about him is negative. Did you ever have any...
I never had anything but pleasure talking with Lou Reed.
Really?
I never had a bad moment with Lou Reed. I feel so lucky that I met him and did a show with him many years ago, and... I used to run into Lori and Lou walking around the West Village with our dogs, and Lou was only lovely and sweet to me. I don't have a bad story about him at all. I cried so hard when he died.
Oh, okay.
I love Lou Reed.
Is there anybody else who, any musicians, songwriters that we may have weird impressions from a distance that you got closer to and can say nice things about?
Oh, I would only say nice things.
Okay.
You know why?
Why?
Because that is the new paradigm. I don't want to send bad things out into the world to just skip around. We've got so much bullshit and crap to wade through. I want to shine a light on the good stories and what is good about all of us. This is my stance at this point in my life. I just want to be a part of the greater good. I'd like to be an important part of a greater good.
Well, by singing and songwriting and appearing on stage, you're doing that. My question, though, is if people go to your website or they check out your Facebook page, what they'll see is, yes, you're appearing at Joe's Pub tonight and you're doing other concerts and things, but you're still pushing the Pink Velour album, which came out in 2008, you know, right after Obama, as you said, took office. Have you written enough songs between then and now to be working on another album, somewhere in the 2020s?
You know what? It will come out this year.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I did not know this. Do you have a title?
You know what? I love to name things, and sometimes I name them before a thing is finished, and sometimes I don't. This is quite a mystery. It's really an important step forward for me, and I don't know what to call it yet, and I think I might have to see the baby's face to know what it's named.
Well, have you written all the songs for it, half of them? You can do any covers?
All of that. I've written half and all of them and covers.
Are you still doing this on your last quote-unquote label, which was Ernester Records, which put out Pink Velour, your own label? Is it on your label? Is it another label? How are you doing it?
In the do-it-yourself universe, I think it behooves one to have your own label if you want to. Mm-hmm. I, of course, wouldn't shy away from, you know, a lucrative offer from a more established label. My label I run out of my cerebellum, and I try to wear all the hats, and it's not the easiest thing, but I'm learning a lot more about how much help I have actually had along the way. Because when you have to do everything for yourself, you realize how much help you probably had getting to where you are right now.
Well, that's funny, because when you run a label out of your own cerebellum, I figured it'd be easy to get ahead. Sorry about that.
Rabbi,
I'm sorry.
You're incorrigible.
I am, and so stop encouraging me. But, you know, are you one of the, like so many musicians now, did you do a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo thing for to get the new album off the ground?
You know, I'm thinking of going to some crowdsourcing. I'm really wanting to see if people could help me find the light of day, so I'm getting some help with that as we speak. Coming up with a crowdfunding idea. I don't want to ask too much from anyone, but I do need help. I need actual support and belief and enthusiasm. So I'm going to ask. I never have asked, but I'm going to. Also, I feel like I know a lot of broke people. A lot of my people are really hurting. Mm. And I don't want to ask them for anything except their undying love.
Well, we all want to be loved. Sort of none of my business, but it isn't. It's a political thing. With Obamacare, did that make a difference in your life? You can at least count on health insurance. Or was that never an issue for you?
You know what's terrible is I haven't signed up for anything. I haven't wanted to need any help, and this is a really irrational ideology, but I just thought, I'm just going to be well. This is my plan. I'm not going to need any help.
And
I also thought I'd let them work out the kinks, and then I'd sign up. So it's one of those things I know I need to do, and I'm going to get help with it because I don't think I'm good at such organizational things. It's probably easier than I imagine. I'm not even sure why I'm delayed. But I've never wanted to be a burden to any system. I really try to, you know, dance around in the margins and be independent. But I do, as a woman in my 50s, I'm increasingly aware that I need some kind of help sometimes. So
oh, please.
I'm going to ask for it. I'm going to ask for it.
Good for you. I mean, as a woman in my 50s, I'm always asking for help, let me tell you. Well, it is. I'm so happy that you have helped us enjoy this past hour of talk and music. One more time, I'm going to remind everybody, please, to go to sidstraw.net. And remember, it's Sid, S-Y-D, like Sydney, sidstraw.net. And of course, run, go, bring, call all your friends, go down to Joe's Pub to see her tonight at 7 o'clock in New York doing a concert, and hopefully many more, and hopefully you will come to my temple here in, well, actually, my real temple's in Great Neck, New York. I'm just slumming here in Colorado with my friend Dave, but that's where my main temple is.
I would be happy to come wherever the temple is.
Oh, that's, you say that now. Yeah, you know, our first temple was working out of a gas station. It was not pleasant. But
I would be really happy to come play the gas station. That sounds fun.
Well, you know what? I would then say thanks to you. Get gas tanked. I'm sorry.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the memories.
There you go. More memories, old and new, from Sid Straw. I thank you so much for joining us in the neighborhood today. Best of luck in your career, in your life, in everything. Oh, and I really hope that tennis player calls back.
You know what? I'll keep you posted, okay? But if he hears about this interview, he might shy away.
Oh, he'll definitely will.
But you know what? Thanks for the wonderful time and the good questions and the hilarity. And, you know, you told me we would speak for half an hour, and somehow it's an hour later. I should have made a second cup of coffee. But I will do that now, and graciously thank you again for helping me keep my work afloat and out there in the cosmos. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate your being here and sharing with us, and I wish you, again, peace, health, and shalom.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Saul Solomon.
Bye-bye now.